This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hscc.org.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning. We
actually use the Kaikyoge Nichiren Shu, but different translation, so I was using the cheat sheet here. It's nice to see that all of you have it memorized. That's great. Today I would like to talk about the six Dharma gates of Tiantai Jury. And if I mispronounce his name, please someone tell me. All these years I've been saying Chi, because, you know, I'm just looking at the paper and trying to reproduce it. So Jury. So I was thinking I was just going to kind of take you through these exercises, but actually I'd like to personalize this a little more and talk about my experience with meditation and Buddhist practice and what the six Dharma gates have meant to me now that I've learned about them in the last year or so. When I first got interested in Buddhism, it was back in the mid-1980s, and I was going to a Catholic boys' school, and a couple of the Christian brothers actually were into Zen, and they would read us these Zen stories. So that was how I first got intrigued by Zen, and then I wanted to know about, you know, Buddhism. I knew how to be a Catholic. I knew the ceremonies and rituals. I knew about the stations of the cross and the using the rosary bead and, you know, the services and such. But I didn't know what it meant to be a Buddhist. What did Buddhists believe? What did Buddhists do? And I read a bunch of books by Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki, Philip Kaplow. That didn't really help, actually. Looking back on that, you know, there were plenty of meditation instructions in those books. In Kaplow's book, in I'm pretty sure I read Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind back then. But for whatever reasons, I never felt that I could just take up meditation. And maybe in looking back, the instructions in these different books were a little different, or maybe it was too subtle for my mind at the time. You know, what do you do with your mind? I could see what to do with your body, but what do you do with your mind? You know, I wanted to know, what should I be doing with my mind? Or maybe what I shouldn't be doing with my mind? Or maybe I needed to know both what I should and should not be doing with my mind? Or maybe I should neither be doing anything nor not doing anything with my mind. You know, what do you do or not? So what eventually happened was I ran into a Japanese religious, I don't know if I want to say the word cult, but a rather eccentric lay group, and learned about chanting Namu Myoho Renge Kyo. Actually, they chanted it Nam Myoho Renge Kyo, because they're always chanting super fast. But apparently that was the right Dharma gate for me at the time, because there were a lot of things about that group I did not like and seemed very un-Buddhist to me. I still feel that way. But the practice they were presenting was actually a genuine Buddhist practice of, excuse me. What was that, order? Of chanting the Daimoku, that means sacred title of the Lotus Sutra, Namu Myoho Renge Kyo, and reciting the Lotus Sutra. So I took up this practice, and after 2 years of diligently chanting every morning, every evening, I found that I actually could just sit silently. And I never would have given myself the chance to do that before, or believed that I could do it. You know, I was always kind of so hyper, and my mind was always racing here and there and trying to figure everything out. But this practice of chanting kind of centered, focused my mind, gave me this discipline to just sit and do this one thing. And then when the time came, when I was able to get instruction, personal instruction meditation, it was at the Shambhala Center, I found, wow, I could do this. I could just sit. Now, I think that they instructed me to follow the breath. They might have instructed me to count the breath. I don't quite remember. But I didn't stick with them for long. I ended up with a Korean Buddhist group who taught meditation on they call it the Tanjun. That's the Korean word. And it's a spot, actually, we're all sitting like this now, where the edge of your palm is touching the belly, that's about where the tendon is, just below the belly button, kind of in the center. It would be the center of gravity when you're sitting. And in East Asia, this isn't a point you focus on just during meditation, but also if you're doing martial arts and various other activities, you should be kind of grounded or centered on this spot, the tanjun in Korean. I call it the tanden, the Japanese way. It actually means elixir field, because that's where the chi supposedly goes to reside and comes from. So I'm not up on all that kind of metaphysics, but that was my understanding. So with the Korean Buddhists, for many years, I learned meditation by focusing on this point, as opposed to just following the breath or counting the breath. Later on, when I joined Nichiren Shu, I went down to the San Jose Temple for the first time, and they do sitting meditation on the first Sunday of every month. And the teacher there, the Venerable Yusho Matsuda, who's now my sensei, was teaching Tanden meditation. And so there it was again. And I'd also run into it in some writings by Hakuin, so, you know, I could see that this was something that, you know, was found a lot of places. Then I began sitting with Taigen. That must have been around 97 or so. And as you may know, I don't know if you know or not, but he doesn't teach Tanden meditation. He teaches Shikantaza, or more objectless awareness, is how I understood, you know, his approach. So here again was another method. You know, so over all these years, I've been taught all these different methods, you know, focusing through chanting a mantra verbally out loud, following the breath, counting the breath, fixing your attention on this spot, the tanden, objectless awareness, you know, all these different methods as they seem to me. Although I would say that Shikantaza seems more like a methodless method. You're not trying to deliberately do anything. That was my understanding of the approach. Now, as a lineage holder in Nichiren Shu, what does this mean to me? You know, because I'm talking about what the Koreans do and what happens in Soto Zen and so on and so forth. Nichiren Buddhism really is a form of streamlined Tiantai Buddhism. That's how I would put it, you know, to put it simply. Tiantai Jari lived in the 6th century. He was confronting a whole bunch of different methods of meditation and practice and ritual practices and forms and many different sutras teaching different goals or different approaches to what Buddhism is about. In Jari's time, finally you had decent translations of the most important Buddhist texts. But the problem was how to organize this into a coherent and practical system. And that's one thing I want to stress about Tiantai, is it's not a scholastic form of Buddhism, as it's sometimes been called. It's a practice-oriented form of Buddhism. But it's not afraid to use the apparatus of scholasticism to create a coherent system of guidance for meditation practice. And by meditation, I don't mean just silent sitting, but also ceremonial meditation as well. You know, walking, chanting, repentance ceremonies, things like that. So Jari brought all this stuff together. And Nichiren was very much hearkening back to the teachings of Jari and also Miao Lo, who was an 8th century reformer of the Tiantai tradition. In Nichiren's time in Japan, Tendai, as they call it in Japan, had very much become an esoteric form of Buddhism. And he wanted to get back to the original teachings and practices. And at the same time, Nichiren changed it a bit by making things even more explicitly oriented on the Lotus Sutra. So my feeling is that part of the heritage that I've received in my lineage is Jari's instructions on meditation. So I set about trying to learn what those actually were, and was very pleased to see when I did finally find decent translations. I pick these up actually at the Zen Center bookstore over on Page Street. And as you see, one of them's about the six Dharma gates. And also, there's a translation by Cleary called Stopping and Seeing, but I think this is the much more helpful translation, a part of Chi Yi's meditation manual, his most important one, The Great Concentration and Insight. This is Neil Donner, Daniel Stevenson. So I read through these, and I finally got a picture of what Jerry Yi was really teaching about meditation, and was quite surprised in a number of ways. One of them was how consistent it seemed to be with what Shakyamuni Buddha taught in the Pali Canon. And the other surprise was how it seemed to converge into what I had understood to be Zen teachings. So it had this great scope that took in both the Pali Canon and, you know, things like how I was perceiving Dogen taught, or Shunryu Suzuki taught, or Taigen had been teaching me. So I started working with this material and seeing that a lot of the things that I had been taught over the years about meditation, following the breath, focusing on the tanden, so on and so forth, were actually part of a system. It wasn't just something here, something there. There was a coherent system. And I would like to say a few words about what that system is. But first I want to mention a little bit of serendipity I ran into just a few days ago. Reverend Myo invited me to attend the study group, Thursday night study group, and right now they're working on the Book of Serenity. So that was Wednesday night I found out about that, so I went home and pulled this off the shelf and just started reading the introduction, the first couple chapters, and lo and behold, Jerry's six Dharma gates are referred to in this book. And it's in the introduction. I just want to read a paragraph here that Cleary's introducing this. He says, one set of meditation exercises formulated by Jerry and recommended in Zen commentary on the Book of Serenity is what is known as the six subtle methods. The Chinese character Ho can also be translated as method, or as Dharma. So that's why he says six subtle methods. A basic form of this practice is indicated in the third story of the Book of Serenity. Yeah, maybe. And various modifications of it are found in the exercises of many Zen schools. Very interesting. I do have a criticism of Cleary, though. He doesn't present the six Dharma gates in context. So I'm going to talk about the six Dharma gates now and try to present them in context. Jury, well, maybe not Jury, but his disciple Guan Ding, who wrote, kind of transcribed Jury's lectures. So, you know, these aren't, this isn't something that Jury wrote. It's basically a transcription of lectures he gave. Guan Ding claimed that Jerry presented three tracks or approaches to meditation. One is the gradual method, and that is what is presented in this book here, The Essentials of Buddhist Meditation. This is sometimes called the small concentration and insight. It's sometimes believed to be a summary of this. But really its approach is one that's most consistent with the Pali Canon, with Vipassana meditation, as might be taught up at, you know, by the insight meditation people. It's a very step-by-step gradual approach. Here's how you sit. Here's what you do with your hands. Here's how you focus on the breath. You know, here's how you can go over the 32 components of the body. All that kind of stuff. Very basic, very traditional. Some might say very Hinayana, although the orientation here is actually Mahayana, especially in that he makes that clear in the last chapter or two. Actually makes it clear in the very beginning where he says you should cultivate bodhicitta even before you begin formal practice. But nevertheless, it's very step-by-step, very gradual, it's not afraid to use discursive thinking in the insight part where you're going over, you know, the components of the body or thinking about the breath, and so on. The second track is Guan Ding calls the variable. And that's neither gradual nor sudden. It's more like whatever you need it to be. And when I say you, I mean the practitioner. You know, if you need to do some more self-conscious techniques like following the breath, counting the breath, then do so. But if you can just jump right in and just keep this open, pure awareness, objectless awareness, then do that. If you fall away from that, use another one of the techniques. So it's he's encouraging just jumping in, you know, what would be sudden, but here are these other techniques as well. That's why it's called variable. You don't go step by step through the six Dharma gates. You just use whichever of them you need if you need them. So this is variable approach. And finally, there is the perfect and sudden approach to meditation, which is, I believe that's where Tiantai and Zen begin to converge. And Cleary would seem to indicate this in his Book of Serenity too, but I think he kind of confuses the issue a little bit by not talking about gradual, variable, sudden. Where exactly is this convergence with Tiantai? And the perfect and sudden is presented here in great calming and insight. But even here, even with this sudden presentation, Jerry is not afraid to present lots of different remedial methods, lots of things for your mind maybe to do if you find yourself slipping away from just being present with what is. Or does he? It's tricky. It's very subtle. But anyway, let me get back to the six Dharma gates. The six Dharma gates are as follows. The first one is counting the breath. And that's this basic technique of just sitting, breathing in, breathing out, one, breathing in, breathing out, two, you go on up to 10, then go back to one again, and just keep counting the cycles of breath. And if you lose the count, just go back to one. You know, when I present this to people who are first coming in learning meditation, I say it's fine if you spend the whole session going one, one, one. That's okay. Because you're learning how your mind is. You're learning how hard it is to keep on, you know, focused on one thing. But this is a very crude method. So Jerry recommends a more subtle one called following. You just follow the breath. You don't need to, you know, add anything to it by counting. Just follow the breath. I cracked open Zen Mind Beginner's Mind the other day, and I saw that Shinryu Suzuki also talks about following the breath. But even that may be a little bit too crude, a little bit too forced, you know. So then he recommends a third method called stabilizing. And unfortunately, in Six Dharma Gates, he's a little vague, at least for me, or at least the translation, but I think that's a very good translation by Bhikkhu Dharmamitra. He's a little vague on what it means to stabilize. My impression, just from going by this, is that you just let the mind be stable. You know, you don't need to do anything with it anymore. You can just drop off following the breath, and just the mind is just there. This is the most subtle of the shamatha, or calming techniques, of the six Dharma gates. So the first three are shamatha, or calming techniques. The next three are going to be vipassana techniques. So you go from the crude to the subtle. And now the next three starts with the crudest of the vipassana techniques, which is contemplation. Cleary talks about contemplating the body. What does he say in here? He says, never mind, who cares what he says? he says that this first technique, you contemplate the components of the body and so forth and so on. Jury talks a bit about that, but what he really focuses on is just contemplating the breath and how the breath is empty. Now, it's clear there could be any object that could be the object of investigation. But the breath is the one that is most close at hand, the one that's most immediate. hopefully you're still breathing while you're meditating. So you just look at the breath. You activate the mind again, as he says, and see, is there anything to grasp here? Is there anything to grasp here? You know, is this oxygen out there the breath? You know, are the lungs by themselves the breath? Is the diaphragm the breath? Is the exchange with the blood the breath? Is it breath when you breathe in? Or does it become breath when you breathe out? Or is it breath at the still point between breathing in and breathing out? Where is breath? You know, so you look at breath and try to see what can I hold on to here that's breath? But what you end up seeing for yourself is process, causes and conditions, just kind of moving through. So Jurdi says, okay, if you do this, you will see that there's nothing to grasp there. So now let's move into something a little more subtle, the fifth Dharma gate. And here's where I think his techniques really start to converge with Zen. The fifth technique is called turning. You turn the attention back on itself. Now, instead of looking at some object like the body or the breath or whatever, you turn the attention around and see, okay, can I get a hold of the mind that is aware? Can I be aware of awareness itself? That's where it gets really tricky. And I love that Zen story where Wiko goes to Bodhidharma and says, please pacify my mind. And Bodhidharma says, well, show me your mind and I'll pacify it for you. And Wiko considers and realizes, I can't produce my mind. And Bodhidharma says, see, I pacified it for you. And I think that that's a dramatization of this fifth Dharma gate, trying to find this mind or awareness that is aware. And you can't, really. So then that brings us to the sixth and the most subtle of the Dharma gates, which is purification, where, now this is kind of where the Heart Sutra is coming from. You know, there's nothing that's pure, nothing that's impure. What are you worried about? There's nothing to grasp out there, nothing to grasp in here. You just abide still upright with that. But I realized a few days ago that, you know, this can get mistaken for the goal. But really, this sixth Dharma gate, purification, is itself just another method. It's a very subtle one. It may be approximate to the unconditioned, but it's still a little bit contrived. And in Juryi's system of teaching, what he's really aiming at is the uncontrived. You know, he talks about different levels of approaching the Four Noble Truths, you know, as just straightforward common sense teaching, or as empty, or as infinite modes of expression, like in the Flower Girl and Sutra, are the perfect way for him is the uncontrived Four Noble Truths, the uncontrived 12-fold chain, the uncontrived anything, uncontrived. You don't force anything. And that brings us back to his perfect and sudden method that he presents in Great Concentration and Insight. So, in learning about these six Dharma gates, I finally had a sense of perspective of all these different methods, you know, like counting and following, and these people over here are saying to focus on the Tanden, and these people here are saying to turn the mind around, you know. Now I see kind of how they fit together. You know, there's the counting, the following, and the fixing of shamatha, or calming. And then there's the contemplation, turning, and purification of vipassana. This is a little out of order, but I talked about how stabilizing or fixing the mind was a little bit vague in the six Dharma gates. It becomes clear from things in here that he may also have meant fixing the mind on a point, like the Tanden, or the tip of the nose if you get tired. So he talks about when to use one or the other. So that's a way of fixing or stabilizing the mind, you know, at one point, instead of following a process or counting the breath. So these are these six methods, remedial methods of bringing your mind back to the present moment. Bringing your mind back from the way it spins off. But the trick is that in the perfect and sudden method, you don't have to self-consciously or deliberately bring your mind back, because there's nowhere for it to go in the first place. And whatever dharmas arise, whether it's, you know, a pain in your knee or your back or cars outside or birds or maybe even the sleepiness or the daydreams that come to you, those dharmas themselves will express true nature. So just be present with that. And when you have the courage, he would even say faith, to just sit with that, then you don't need to bring in these other methods. You know. I would like to end with a couple quotes. The first is from the introduction to The Great Concentration and Insight by Guanding. I'd just like you to hear this, because it's Guanding's understanding of the perfect and sudden method. The perfect and sudden tranquility and insight from the very beginning takes ultimate reality as its object. No matter what the object of insight might be, it is seen to be identical to the middle. There is here nothing that is not true reality. When one fixes the mind on the Dharma realm as object and unifies one's mindfulness with the Dharma realm as it is, then there is not a single sight nor smell that is not the middle way. The same goes for the realm of self, the realm of Buddha, and the realm of living beings. Since all aggregates and sense bases of body and mind are thusness, there is no suffering to be cast away. Since ignorance and the afflictions are themselves identical with enlightenment, there is no origin of suffering to be eradicated. Since the two extreme views are the middle way, and false views are the right view, there is no path to be cultivated. Since samsara is identical with nirvana, there is no cessation to be achieved. Because of the intrinsic inexistence of suffering at its origin, the mundane does not exist. Because of the inexistence of the path and cessation, the supramundane does not exist. A single unalloyed reality is all there is. No entities whatever exist outside of it. That all entities are by nature quiescent is called tranquility. That, though quiescent, this nature is ever luminous is called insight. Though a verbal distinction is made between earlier and later stages of practice, there is ultimately no duality, no distinction between them. This is what is called the perfect and sudden tranquility and insight. A couple really important points made among many in here is that this is no longer a step-by-step approach. And tranquility and insight, shamatha vipassana here, are no longer separate. It's no longer you first pacify the mind and then you work on vipassana. It's all there at once. And not just in the practitioner, but all things are inherently quiescent and luminous. This is perfect and sudden perspective. And then the last thing I'd like to share with you is Nichiren's perspective on meditation. He says, I guess I should preface this. There's a teaching in that Juri has in The Great Concentration Insight called the 3,000 worlds in a single thought moment. I'm not going to tell you what all that is now. I think a handy way of summarizing that is just to say that in anything is everything. In anything is everything. And it was Juri's way of expressing how things seem to him when practicing perfect and sudden shamatha vipassana. So Nichiren makes reference to this. Since the Great Concentration and Insight preaches the way of practicing the spiritual contemplation according to the doctrine of 3,000 worlds in a single thought moment in the Lotus Sutra, the way to practice the threefold contemplation in a single thought is nothing but recognizing the wonderful Dharma to be beyond conceptual understanding. Therefore, monks who belittle the Lotus Sutra and make too much of spiritual contemplation commit the grave sin of slandering the true Dharma. Our men of false view are as devilish as a heavenly devil. This is because, according to Grand Master Tian Tai's threefold contemplation in a single thought, Concentration and insight means the unique state of mind in which one is awakened with the truth of the one Buddha teaching through steadily maintaining the mind in tranquility by the Lotus Sutra. I've got to confess, I'm not sure what he means by that. You know, I have some guesses. But I think what Nichiren is saying is that the Jiri's perfect and sudden contemplation and insight is fulfilled not through some special method, but simply by having this, in this moment, this faith in the wondrous Dharma, this faith that what the Lotus Sutra is expressing, the one Buddha vehicle, the eternity of the Buddha, all these various things that it presents in a mytho-poetic form, will itself just become self-evident if you just allow it, if you just have this confidence and trust to just be present to it in this moment.
Sorry to interrupt.
Yes, in fact, I'm ending now.
There's another group actually coming in a little after 11, so I thought if we want to switch to question and answer.
Yeah.
And I just want to say briefly, that was a very rich, delightful meal. Thank you very much. Also, the last bit that you said conjured Dogen in my mind when he starts to speak of not just practice, but practice and verification. Mm-hmm. Because that exact heart you're describing is where verification comes from, right, in the midst of practice. So, if you'd like to entertain questions.
Yeah, that's a perfect time, because that was that's the last thing I wanted to say. So, who has a comment, question? When I was in the NROTC, we had the officer who was in charge, you know, after he gave his lectures, he would always say, comments, questions, answers. I really liked that. So clear as mud? Yes?
Oh, no, I was just...
Okay.
Sorry.
It does, to me anyway, it really does show at least for practitioners who find themselves within a living tradition, there really isn't much contradiction all the way back to Shakyamuni. I really think that's, you see that over and over again.
Yeah. You know, I met a young man from Thailand who had spent time as a monk, as I guess he said about 50% of them do when they're college age or whatever, coming of age. They'll spend at least one rainy season retreat as a monk, and it's believed that that will bring great merit to the family. And so I asked him about his experience, you know, and he talked about learning Vipassana meditation in the style that they do in Thailand, where it's very deliberate, very, you know, there's the kidneys and the lungs and this and that and the other thing. And then I told him about how I teach meditation of faithful fools and about how you just sit and, you know, whatever comes up, whatever you feel or you hear or you think, you know, you just be aware of it and let it go. And he says to me, oh, you teach Mahayana meditation. And I was a little annoyed by that. Well, not annoyed, but I was flabbergasted. Maybe that's the right word. It's kind of like, I don't think it is, actually. Mm-hmm. And I told him that I didn't think it was Mahayana meditation. I think it was what the Buddha was getting at. And I said to him, you know, when I read the Satipatthana Sutra, the Foundations of Mindfulness in the Pali Canon, yeah, I see he says, you know, go over the components of the body or go over this or that. You know, in the Anapanasati Sutta, he talks about breathing in long. I'm aware I'm breathing in long and all that. But, you know, I think that's just a literary way of the Buddha saying, just be aware of what's there. You know, sure, you can approach it self-consciously and deliberately and analytically the way this young man was taught, but I think these discourses of the Buddha imply something much more direct, much more, well, as Jerry says, uncontrived. You know, if I'm going to be riding down the Nevada desert, for instance, you know, somebody will tell me beforehand, oh, there's going to be a gas station about 30 miles down, and, you know, if you're getting low on gas, you might want to stop there first before you keep going, because in the other 2 miles, other 2 hours, there's not going to be anything, you know, and then at the end of that, you'll find some hotel. You know, somebody will tell me beforehand what's there. So as I'm driving down the road, I'm not going, okay, gas station 3 miles ahead, 120 miles, there's going to be this, that. I'm not going to be thinking about all that, but I'm going to be aware. It's going to be in the back of my mind, my awareness. Here's what I may see. Here's what might come up. And I think that's what the Buddha is teaching. So as far as I'm concerned, this isn't Mahayana meditation or Hinayana meditation. There's just this tradition of meditation. And I think they all aim at this uncontrived direct awareness. But on the other hand, there's all these remedial techniques for those who, and I've seen this, will come in to a meditation session and within like a couple minutes get scared and run out. I mean, literally run out the door. I've seen this several times, and I think for them, maybe, saying, okay, let's just count the breath. Or let's just follow the breath. Give them something to hold on to give them a little bit of security before they can let even that go. Yes?
I'm not really sure what the distinction is between the six Dharmakaya purification method and the other, sudden method is.
Yeah, well, between purification and sudden, it gets very close. But here's my understanding, that, as I said, there's the last three of the Dharma gates are about Vipassana, right? So you contemplate objects and see there's nothing to grasp. You turn the awareness back on itself, see, yet again, there's nothing to grasp. So the sixth one, purification, is realizing that, let's see, I think I have a quote here so I can say directly what Jerry instructs. As for the cultivation of purification, through realizing the purity of the form aggregate, one refrains from generating false thoughts about it and does not course in discriminations regarding it. So you're not caught up in form anymore, or even objectified thought. The same is true with respect to the aggregate of feeling, perception, formative factors, and consciousness. One puts to rest the defilement of false thinking. This constitutes the cultivation of purification. One also puts to rest the defilement in coursing in discriminations. This too qualifies as the cultivation of purification. One puts to rest the defilement of grasping at a self as well. This is also what is intended by the cultivation of purification. To state what is essential, if one is able to bring it about that his mind conforms to its fundamental purity, this qualifies as a cultivation of purification. If one does not ultimately apprehend any subjective entity that is able to cultivate, any objective sphere that is cultivated, or anything that qualifies as either pure or impure, this qualifies as the cultivation of purification. So there's a little bit of deliberate effort here, but now it's very subtle, and it's that deliberate effort of just not grasping. You're kind of reminding yourself or pushing yourself to letting go of objective or even subjective phenomena. Just let it be. But in perfect and sudden, you don't need to do even that much. There's this faith that not only is ultimate reality something that you don't need to add anything to or take anything away from, but that in fact you can't add anything to it or take anything away from it. So you can just let it be.
On that wise note, I heard her arriving already.
Oh, okay.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much for a wonderful talk.
Sure, thank you.